Betty came by on her way, said she had a word to say about things today. Said she hadn't heard the news, hadn't had the time to choose a way to lose, but she believes. Gonna see the river man, gonna tell him all I the plan. For lilac time. If he tells me all he knows about the way his river flows and all night shows in summertime.
Okay, you are listening to WGXC 90.7 Accra, The Wave Farm. This is Radio for Open Ears, and this is the newest installment of my show. It is called Reading is Functamental. What is Reading is Functamental about? It's all about books about music, and I interview musicians and authors of books about music. Today, we have a really special treat. It is one of the music's greatest producers and sort of Zelig's. He's been everywhere. He was, his name is Joe Boyd. He may be best known for Nick Drake and some of his early artists that he produced in London and discovered. But he, his music life and music started really early. He was involved at Harvard in bringing blues artists to England with George Wein. He was the sound guy when Dylan went electric at Newport. He was famous. He went to London. He actually was the person in charge of the Elektra label in London. He opened a club called UFO, where he saw Pink Floyd. He actually produced the first Pink Floyd single before he was kind of booted by EMI when they signed them. He discovered and produced the Incredible String Band, John Martin, one of my favorites, Nick Drake. Then he went on to form Hannibal Records, which was one of the pioneering labels dealing with global music. He signed Cubanissimo. He put out records of Tuvan Throat Singers. And that sort of ran. He also did Richard Thompson and artists like like Robert Wyatt during Hannibal. He wrote a book about his great career called White Bicycles, Making Music in the 60s, which came out around 2007. But his latest is what we're here to really talk about today, and it is the consummate book on the history of global music, and it's called And the Roots of Rhythm Remain. It's a really incredible book, 900 pages of details about how sort of rhythm and modes moved around the world, the impact of music from Africa, Cuba, Argentina, all over the place, India, on pop music, and vice versa, Western influence on world music. So let's just get at it and talk to Mr. Joe Boyd.
We are here with the fantastic, one of my favorite, a guy I really idolized for a long time, Joe Boyd, an amazing producer, curator of great music and also film, and the author of two excellent books. The latest is this book, And the Roots of Rhythm Remain, which is an excellent, the comprehensive history of music across the globe and how it sort of migrated and intermingled. And then his earlier book, which is one of the best books about the 60s, White Bicycles, which was really a memoir of his time making music in the 60s. So thank you for giving us your time, Joe.
A pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, let's start with the Roots book. It was a real process creating it. 17 years, a lot of research, a lot of travel. Give us a little bit of an overview of what the book is and really how you came to write it.
Well, I was delighted that people liked White Bicycles. A lot of people came up to me when at book signings and said, "So you're going to write a book about the 70s next?" I said, "No way. I don't have anything to say about the 70s, or at least nothing good anyway."
Right.
And I was always very conscious in my flat in London. I have a lot of books and a lot of books about music, and there's some fantastic books about Anglo-American music, you know, Peter Guralnick, Nick Toshes, all these great guys, you know, who've written these wonderful books, very focused on Anglo-American music. And yet everybody knows salsa, reggae, gypsy music from Eastern Europe, samba, tango, Indian music. But even though these musics are familiar to us in the sound, we know very little about the cultures that they grew out of and the heroic pioneers who created the forms that we experienced. Because every culture has their Elvis Presley, their Beatles, their James Brown, their, you know, these great figures, these larger than life figures whose lives and careers are just as interesting as, you know, Sam Cooke's or Jarvis Cocker's or the Rolling Stones, you know. So that was kind of one of the tasks. And then I also was aware of the fact that there's a lot behind the music that has shaped our music. Our music has been shaped by, nothing is pure, everything is mongrel. Mm-hmm. And our Anglo-American music particularly. And discovering some really surprising, extraordinary things as I did my research just reinforced my desire to keep going. For example, the whole idea of syncopation, which is one of the foundation stones of rock and roll and American music, entered the American bloodstream through New Orleans from the Caribbean, from Cuba and Haiti. And had a huge impact because America basically had no drums. Mm-hmm. You know, the original the Protestant Anglophone colonizers in the 17th and 18th centuries would not allow slaves to have drums. Mm-hmm. And they brought originally the first 100 or 150 years, they brought most of the slaves from Northern Africa, from the Sahel, where there are very few trees and very few drums. And so and they have all these stringed instruments. It's a very strong vocal culture, the Sahel. And so, you know, African American music became very much based on stringed instruments and singing. And then, you know, when we bought Louisiana from Napoleon, suddenly New Orleans was part of America. And when Americans went to New Orleans, they were astonished. You know, every Sunday there were these jam sessions in Congo Square with drums and hand clapping and dancing and all these very African rhythmic traditions, which had never been part of American music. And this mixture, this blend that happened there and continued on right the way up. And New Orleans has always been like the drip valve. Mm-hmm. You know, like Professor Longhair jamming with Cuban sailors in waterfront bars in the 1940s and getting that syncopation right into his left hand. Mm. And because in Cuba, they had a completely different attitude. You know, the Catholic attitude is pretty much like the Roman Empire. You know, they used to conquer people, bring their rulers in chains to Rome, and then set up a shrine to their gods. Like, hey, whatever's going, any gods you got, it's all right, as long as you obey the emperor. And the Catholic Church is a bit more like that. They would allow Africans to pretend that Santa Barbara was, that Chango was really saying it's Santa Barbara, mm-hmm. you know, and to worship saints as if they were African gods, mm-hmm. and to play their drums and have their speak their African languages, maintain mm-hmm. their culture, because they found people were just happier and worked longer, and you know.
Well, actually, that is where the book begins. I think you wrote probably one of the quintessential first sentences of a book after Dickens, of course. the book begins with Malcolm McLaren was bored. And I just have to digress for a second. Myself and my girlfriend, I believe it was in the 80s sometime, were down on the west side. We went out on the piers in New York City, and we saw this crew of people with this boombox with horns in it. And we were like, who are these crazy people? They were taking pictures and stuff. And I think that was the actual cover. That was the boombox used on the cover of that Malcolm McLaren album.
Okay.
but you really talk about, it really does start with Africa, and specifically with Paul Simon, Graceland, the different kinds of music, the Zulu music versus what the ANC was. So if you want to maybe go into a little bit of that.
Yeah. Well, you know, in a way, what part of the point of the book is, you know, there's everybody, people talk about the world music movement that started with Graceland and in the late 80s, and there were columns in newspapers of world music record reviews and concert series. But, and people kind of criticized it or applauded it as a kind of new thing. But this goes back forever. I mean, you know, this interplay of cultures with the West, the so-called West. And there's a pattern that you can detect if you look back, that when Western culture in the 19th century, in the early 19th century, a lot of the romantics felt that Western culture had reached a dead end and needed something fresh. And they found it with Roma music. You know, they started dancing and going to see Roma musicians, and Liszt became a star by imitating Roma musicians. So what was happening with Paul Simon wasn't anything new. It was just a continuation of a pattern that had gone back in our history. But I thought I'd start with that story because it is so much in that story. And in a way, that first sentence, Malcolm McLaren was bored. Malcolm McLaren is kind of a stand-in for us. You know, we're a little bored in the 80s because it's all disco and punk and glam rock and stuff like this. And for a lot of listeners, we were missing the kind of virtuosic live energy that grew out of the explosion of blues and rock in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And in a way, people started looking to Africa, looking to Eastern Europe, looking to Latin America for inspiration, an injection of life. And I think Paul Simon did it really well, and Malcolm McLaren not so much. And he also grabbed copyrights melodies and copyrighted them, registered them in his name, which is, to me, I mean, people accuse Paul Simon of cultural appropriation, but I think Malcolm McLaren was much more guilty of cultural appropriation. So that was not like it. And it's also the place that a story that people think they know, but people, much as people know about Graceland, very few people knew about the conflicts behind the scenes between the Zulu culture and the rest of South Africa. And one detail that I gleaned I had a wonderful interview with Paul Simon. I've known him a little bit over the years, and I emailed him and I said, can I talk to you about Graceland? He said, oh, I'm so tired of talking about Graceland. I mean, I'll give you 15 minutes. And we talked for 2.5 hours.
Right.
And it was just great. And one of the details he told me was that Miriam Makeba, who was a stalwart of the anti-apartheid resistance, she joined the Graceland tour when they went started doing live shows. All during the tour, she never once looked at or spoke to the Ladysmith Black Mambazo guys. She just, every time she passed them in the hallway, she turned her head the other way. It was a complete divide. And what does that mean? What, how does that, and so I dived back into the history of South Africa to discover what that all means. What's it all about? And in a way, you could say that this book is kind of a history book,
really
masquerading as a music book.
Right. But it is, it does set everything within a political context and within sort of a lifestyle context of, you know, speaking of like tropicalismo, you know, that was obviously a reaction. Yeah. So a lot of this music was a reaction. There's also a very good story. Forgive me if I'm pronouncing Mumbai, the tune.
Mumbai.
Yeah. If you could tell us sort of a little bit.
Yeah. That, of course, is the original. That's another reason I like to start with South Africa, because that Mumbai is the original cultural appropriation,
right?
You know, because one of the biggest songs of the 20th century in terms of number of covers, amount of income generated by it, is The Lion Sleeps Tonight. And that was a kind of adaptation or rip-off, depending on who you talk to, of Wimaway, which was Pete Seeger in the Weavers number,
which was
in turn a borrowing or a ripoff, depending on your point of view, of a record by Solomon Linda and the original Evening Birds that was recorded in 1938 in South Africa, called Mbube, which is about a lion, and it's an improvised vocal line that gives you that famous hook melody.
Right.
Da 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 da. And that famous melody was invented by Solomon Linda.
Right.
And he died without ever receiving a penny. And there's actually a documentary on Netflix now called The Lion's Share about the story of that. And it's a fascinating story. And when I do my events, my wife and I always do these things together, and we play Lion Sleeps Tonight, Wimaway, and then we play Mbube.
Right.
And it's so powerful, that moment, because, I mean, they're all great records.
Right.
You know, I mean, Pete Seeger did a fantastic job of creating something with Wimaway. And, you know, the Tokens, that's kind of like one of the definitive falsetto vocals of the doo-wop era.
Yes, definitely.
But then you hear Solomon Linda, and it's just so profound and moving. And that's the original. That's the source. Anyway, it's a fun thing.
Then you also speak about, when you speak about the drummer Tony Allen, you speak about, I guess, how there was an impact from the States to him when he
it's all circular.
He got a subscription to a Downbeat magazine, or is that how this came about?
Yeah, and he, you know, I got to know Tony a bit. I was his music publisher for a while, and we had lunch in Paris when I was starting this book, and I interviewed him, and he told me he loved this story that when he started to play the drums. And he was playing in a high life band, and he always went to see the top high life bands to see what their drummers were up to. And most of them were from Ghana, and they would come down the coast to Lagos, and he would go to see them play. And on this one particular night, he'd watched this top band, and he just couldn't understand why the drummer just played this very repetitive pattern, and he never touched the hi-hat.
Right.
And Tony went home going, oh, I wonder what that's all about. Why doesn't he ever play the hi-hat? And the very next morning, through his letterbox, drops his Downbeat subscription. And there's a special booklet inside by Max Roach saying how to play the hi-hat. And so it's like, oh, okay. So he goes and he starts doing all these exercises at Max Roach. And then he starts using the hi-hat when he plays with the band. And all the other highlife musicians are like, whoa, what's that? You know?
Yeah.
And that is the roots of Afrobeat. That's where Afrobeat comes from. It's the way Tony would keep the beat going on the hi-hat. It's so cool the way he played. And he's just such a fantastic character. I couldn't resist. He and Fela are just two of the most vivid and interesting characters. And
again, people entwined with politics, with their, local politics and national global politics. Another really interesting part of the book is, again, you sort of travel around the globe. They're really like almost individual books on small books on Cuba, Jamaica, Brazil, Argentina, Eastern Europe. I was pretty fascinated with a lot of the projections on the Indian section of the book, not realizing that the great Ravi Shankar started as a dancer and then kind of got talked into becoming the virtuoso he was. And then your connections of how this influenced everything from gypsy jazz to John Coltrane to the Beatles, of course, and the Byrds, Amal Thomas.
Yeah. There's one of my favorite quotes in the book is Paul McCartney, very early on in their growing interest in Indian music, he brought all the Beatles together into a room to listen to a Ravi Shankar LP. And they listened through to a whole raga. And then as he lifted the needle off the disc, he turned to the other guys in the group and he said, "Did anyone else notice that they never changed key?"
Yeah.
And that was such a revolution to John Coltrane. John Coltrane, of course, years before, had discovered Indian music and discovered that the Western scale and the idea of Western chords and harmonies is not universal.
Right.
It's not the absolute. That there's other ways of playing music and looking at music. And Indian music is all based on scales. And every raga, I mean, I never knew this, but I discovered every raga has like, you go up, I think, 6 notes. And then you come down. When you come down, one of the notes is different coming down than going up. And there's a difference between two ragas depending on whether you bend the note from below to reach it or you bend the note from above to reach it.
Wow.
And the notes themselves are not all the white or the black keys.
Right.
Some of them are in between. And in a way, that's how you get to the blues.
Right.
Because African music has these pentatonic scales that have notes that are not on the piano or not on a guitar fret. And there's a kind of DNA memory of these notes in African Americans. And they're looking for it between the 6th and 7th note.
Mm-hmm.
And they bend the note down to look, they're like that bending, that blue note of the bent guitar string, or Thelonious Monk playing two adjacent notes together and hitting them really hard. Like he's trying to get in between them, you know, to find that other note that's missing. Anyway, that was all fascinating for me as I wrote the book, and I hope it's as equally interesting to readers.
Well, it's also very interesting. I mean, the book really, we're talking about the migration of two elements here, rhythm and scales, really.
Scales
and rhythm. Another fascinating part of the rhythm section was when you were talking about the habanera beat, I believe. And where that, how it's Cuban, how it transferred, how it really went from travel from Africa to Havana, to New Orleans, to early rock and roll. So if you want to maybe
With a little detour, there's actually, as much as it's Cuban, it's also Haitian.
Mm.
Because one of the things that the biggest events that changed the course of Western music was the Haitian Revolution, where the slaves rebelled in Haiti and threw off the French. And the French, you know, plantation owners grabbed as many slaves as they could and fled to Cuba, and some of them to New Orleans. But the big impact was in Cuba, where there was already a kind of whole dance scene. But when the Haitians arrived, it exploded, because their traditional dances, the dances which were basically contredanse, which was a French, like, gavotte, kind of like a square dance. It was like the roots of American square dance. And the Haitians came, and they just gave it this rhythm that was new and very African and very sensual. And out of that grew this pattern, dump, da-dump, dump, dump, which you hear in St. Louis Blues in the middle eight, and you hear it in Carmen, and you hear it, you know, all over our musical landscape. And it was so infectious. It spread to Spain, it spread to Argentina, where it became the tango. And it's, and you hear it in the left hand of rock and roll. Dum, 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 dum,
right. dum, Little dum. Richard,
yeah.
And
yeah, all that. It's all starts with the habanera. Mm-hmm. So, you know, tracing that was a lot of fun.
And then also obviously the impact of Cuban music on jazz, on the Dizzy Gillespie and Chano Bozzo, yeah. And all that kind of thing too.
Yeah.
It's very, very interesting. I also really like the Brazilian section. It's a favorite kind of music of mine. And again, you talk about Gilberto. I think I saw in another interview, you said something about your own theory. It wasn't expressed to you during his lifetime, but that there might have been an impact on Nick Drake from
well, Boston. I mean, yeah, I never, you know, I talked to Nick about his record collection, what he listened to, and I saw his record. I think I thumbed a bit through his records once when I visited his home. And I don't have any memory of him having Bossa Nova records. But the more I got into listening to João Gilberto, the more I thought, you know, this sounds a bit Nick Drake-like sometimes, you know. And then I listened, then I was looking, because a lot of times when I do a talk about this book, and then we get to the Q&A, somebody says, what was it like working with Nick Drake? And, and suddenly I have to go back to, and which is, you know, it's fine. I don't, you know, I'm very proud of my work with Nick Drake, so I don't mind talking about it, but it's sort of, how do we keep it together with talking about the new book?
Right.
And Andrea, my wife, and I were listening to things, and we listened to Riverman. Mm-hmm. And for opening chords of Riverman, thought, So I went listening through to Gilberto's recordings, and I found a live recording of Desafinado that starts very, very like Riverman, you know. And so I play those two things back to back sometimes. And as I did meet a friend of Nick's once, who said, yeah, I think he had a João Gilberto record in his collection.
Yeah. And so, the softness of the vocal approach too.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's a lot of the, in terms of the texture. Yeah. Before we depart for your old history, which we'll go through briefly, I wanted to talk to you about Jamaican music. And really, you know, the connection between these gentlemen who created the sound systems, and really how reggae sort of came about, because they were looking for records to play, because they were very, proprietary about what they played. Like, they didn't want to play what each other had played. So these gentlemen, you know, Cox and Dodd and Duke Reed and Scratch Perry, how they became producers, and then how maybe DJ Herc, who was Jamaican, how it influenced rap.
Well, it's a fascinating story. And one of the little details, which I hadn't realized before I did the research, which I loved, was how Jamaicans just loved American R&B, but they only loved certain kinds. You know, they loved this sort of slow shuffle, jump blues. They didn't like things too fast. It's so hot in Jamaica. Right. You know, you don't want to ruin your clothes with sweat dancing to Little Richard, you know. And so the kind of sexy grooves of sort of late 40s, early 50s R&B was what they really liked. Mm-hmm. And as the 50s went on and white kids in America started joining the party, mm-hmm. Alan Freed's, you know, revolution turning into rock and roll. White kids loved fast dancing, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard, Chuck Berry. And that became more of the style of records that were released. And the Jamaicans were like, wait a minute, we used to get a steady supply of records from America that we loved. And now they're harder to find. We don't have so much stuff we like. Maybe we better make our own, like the stuff we like, this sort of jump blues from the late 40s that we really liked. And so the early ska is like, and actually fascinatingly, if you listen to some of the really early ska records, they do sound very American. Mm-hmm. And then it's just this inexorable shift where the starts to be, you know, like the emphasis starts to be on the two and the four instead of the one and the three. And it just shifts so slightly. And just that slight shift, it teaches you how extraordinary and fundamental the nuances of rhythm are, right, to music. Because just this tiny shift of where that accent is placed changed everything and created, yeah, this industry in Jamaica that went from ska to rock steady to reggae and then eventually to dub. Mm-hmm. Because the truth was, in Jamaica, it began to be too dangerous in a way to have singers and bands live in clubs. You know, there was too much violence going on.
Right.
So the only thing that would work would be DJs. And then the DJs, you know, they were just, Jamaicans are so, and I talk the background of that island and why it's such a unique place. It was cut off.
Right.
It wasn't part of the Caribbean, really. It wasn't part of even the British Caribbean. It was very much its own, had its own ideas and its own philosophies. And then they had, you know, when the sugar cane business failed, because nobody wanted to cut cane after the end of slavery, they started growing rope,
right,
which means growing hemp.
Yes.
And they became like one of the world's biggest suppliers of hemp for rope.
Right.
Which, of course, you could smoke the buds. And so, you know, this whole island became.
And thus, you know, came dub.
And thus came dub. And one of the Jamaicans who migrated to the Bronx was Cool Herc, you know.
Right.
And he brought these ideas from Jamaica, like spinning two discs of the same disc to keep a James Brown drum solo going for 5-10 minutes,
toasting,
by switching back and forth, and then toasting over it.
Yes.
And nobody ever heard anything like this.
No.
And they were just amazed. And but it's a loop. It's a feedback loop, because a lot of the Jamaican toasters were copying the kind of jive that R&B disc jockeys, they would hear from American radio.
Right.
Who used to talk over the intros. You know, they would. There were a lot of black DJs in America who would talk over the intros to records,
right?
And then Jamaicans imitated that, but they would do it in a completely original and wacky way that that just caught the imagination of people in America.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, this book is just fantastic. It's fascinating. It's also, don't be afraid. Don't think it's academic. It's very readable. It's very much. An interesting, you know, narrative. It's more storytelling than, you know, than textbook. So we, yeah, don't want to scare people away. And it's, no, it goes by fast, you know, considering the size of it.
And the paperback is coming out in a couple of weeks.
Right. And did you get the website together yet with the listening?
No,
the audiobook.
It's a painful subject. It turns out to be such, I mean, it took me way longer than I thought to do the audiobook.
Right.
So I just got that finished in December.
Wow.
So that's up now. And then, you know, I've been doing all this touring and a lot of interviews, and I started doing the webpage with all the links. And there's so much. There's documentaries, there's little mini documentaries about these different people, there's clips online. So I'm building up, and I haven't even got finished with chapter one, but I'm almost finished with South Africa. So as soon as that's finished, I'm going to put that up on the website and people can follow the book and just go down rabbit hole, as many rabbit holes as they want.
Yeah, well, the book ain't going anywhere. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's
going to
be around for a long time, as is this book, which is one of my favorite of the memoir of the 60s, because, you know, I'm sure you're tired of being called a rock and roll zealot, but you really had a knack for being in the right place at the right time. And some of that really, let's jump ahead to the 80s, your interest really in what is now called world music, you actually helped to really create the genre, was when you formed Hannibal Records in the 80s. So if you could just give us a little bit on Hannibal.
Well, Hannibal, I mean, you know, at the end of the 60s, which I talk about in the book, I was kind of exhausted. My company had failed because people gave us good reviews, but not enough people bought the records.
Right.
And I took a job at Warner Brothers Movies, film company.
Made a great Jimi Hendrix movie.
Yeah, which we're going to show in Sorites on Monday night.
Oh, you are? Great. We're going to talk about that one.
Okay. And and so I thought, making that Jimi Hendrix movie, hey, I'm now a film producer.
Right.
I had a hit with Maria Muldaur's Midnight at the Oasis.
Yeah.
And of course I spent all that money, which wasn't that much, but still, optioning books and commissioning scripts and trying to be a player in Hollywood. And it didn't really work. And by 1980, I was kind of like, oh God, let me get back. These putting together a film is so complicated. If I have an idea for a record, I could just go in the studio, record it in 2 days.
Right.
And put it out in 2 months. And that's what I want to do. And so I started Hannibal Records. And initially, you know, my orientation was more like among the first 13, Hannibal 1301, 1302, 1303, 1304 are defunct.
Unbelievable.
Downtown funk band. Kate and Anna McGarrigle.
Right.
Richard and Linda Thompson.
Incredible.
And Jeff Muldaur.
Right.
And then 1305 was The Rumor. And I think 1306 was Joe King Carrasco and the Crowns.
Right.
So you can see where I was going with this label. But it became eventually obvious to me that there wasn't really, I mean, you know, you really needed to be financed to compete with other, more and more labels, big labels were putting out singer-songwriters and rock bands. And, you know, I felt when I formed it, it was a sort of a trough period where punk and disco and glam rock were dominating. And so I was going to do something different. But then more people began doing that. And my brother kept saying, whose record collection I'm now sitting here in Albuquerque taping or record digitizing. He always said to me, you should put out a Ladysmith Black Mambazo record. You should put out the Mystère de Bois Bulgare.
Wow.
And you should, you know. And I said, oh, come on, Warwick. You know, I love those records, but it's not commercial. You know, I got to sell some records here.
Right.
You know, and of course, by the late 80s, it was clear that that was a much better idea than trying to find the next James Taylor.
Right.
You know,
well, you were, and, Yeah, you were ahead of the curve with Cubanissimo. You
Well,
mentioned.
that was in the 90s. That was the
Oh,
90s.
that was there. Okay.
That was later. But yeah, I was a bit, I mean, that was a, that was, but you know, I started putting out records by Musicash from Hungary and the Trio Bulgarka from Bulgaria and Ivo Papazov and Tumani Diabate, the great kora player. And this was really, I realized, was more my calling as a label guy.
Right.
And then in the 90s, yeah, I went to, I started going down to, and this is something I write about, this is where the stories connect, I guess. I started going down to the Village Gate in New York on Monday nights to hear salsa meets jazz. And out of that grew the Cubanismo project,
Oh, wow.
which was before
Exactly.
Buena Vista. And actually, one of my most, you know, because in a way, you know, the kind of records I've ended up making, not because I necessarily like this music better, but just because, I don't know, this is the way it's worked out, has been, you know, music people listen to sitting down, a lot of it. And when Cubanismo came out, which was this all-star group of Cuban, great Cuban musicians recorded in Havana. And it, we released the record and it immediately just caught a wave and started selling much more than Rykodisc, who was my parent company by now, expected. And one night, about 2 months after the release, I was in New York and I had to go see an artist way over in Avenue D. And then I had another gig. A jazz, a friend of mine was playing with a jazz group way over on Hudson Street. And so, in the middle of a Saturday night, like 10:30 in a, at night on a Saturday night, I walked from Avenue D over to Hudson Street, right across the Village and Soho.
In 1980.
In 19, well, no, this, no, this was 1996.
Oh, okay. We were starting to
1996.
gentr we're starting to gentrify then.
Yeah. And yeah, and there were a lot of new hip bars and
Yeah.
stuff. And on the way, I heard my Cubanismo record coming out of three bars from between Avenue A, Avenue D, and Hudson Street. Just without my doing anything, it was just that was what they were playing for a Saturday night party in the bars. And I would just walk past and just go, oh. And just I, it was just the greatest feeling to have finally some of my records, not just, you know, for nerds sitting in their bed, you know, in their rooms listening to Richard Thompson, but you know, Saturday night party animals moving to my record. I thought, oh yeah, finally.
Well, your other, you know, your other great era, which I think you end up spending probably a bulk of your existence prior to this book talking about is London in the 60s. And
Yeah.
I just wanted to briefly touch on, you know, all the amazing stuff that you did with your production company, Rich Season there. So you went there to work for Elektra Records and then started your own imprint production
Yeah.
company. And
Yeah.
some of the great, you know, music, obviously Fairport Convention, Nick Drake. You recorded the first Pink Floyd single, Soft
Single,
Machine.
just a single,
Yeah,
yeah.
no, the single, yeah. And then
Yeah,
EMI
yeah.
came in and said,
Yeah.
they shut it down, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's in a, yeah, a favorite of mine is John Martin. So how, you know, how long was that period? And I guess what were some of the highlights for you of that period? And then, you know, how you kind of feel about the resonance of this music. It really does continue. Nick's career is a great example of it. How it's kind of
Well,
like
yeah,
had a
I mean, I
lasting
think
effect.
it was a great era. I think music, art, literature, every art form, you know, goes in waves. You know, it has great periods. And John Lennon, I saw a documentary with the Beatles the other day, and there was a interview with John Lennon, and he just said, "Hey, it was all about the end of conscription, you know, the fact that they cut off the draft. They didn't draft all the young male Brits suddenly. And so all these guys, working class kids, there were all these grants to go to art schools, you know, yeah. and all these art schools, these suddenly freed from the draft hanging over them, formed bands, you know, mm-hmm. and it was when I arrived in Britain in 64, it was such a creative atmosphere. And so that period from 64 to 68 mm-hmm. was just so fruitful and just full of, you know, every Friday there'd be new records released, you
right.
know. And I never forget at the UFO Club, which I
right, yeah.
formed with my friend John Hopkins, who was a real pioneer of the whole underground scene. And we had Procol Harum as the kind of support act the day Whiter Shade of Pale was released.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they played Whiter Shade of Pale in the club. And then the next day, you walked down King's Road and you right. heard the record coming out of every boutique,
yeah.
you know, and then next 7 days later, there'd be another new record that was right. kind of amazing. And, it was very exciting. I mean, you know, I was very privileged to be in the middle of all of that. And there was, again, it's like what I talk about in the new book, mm-hmm. the way cultures influence each other and things people borrow from each other. And I was, in some ways, this is a bit of an exaggeration, but I was kind of like an ambassador of a certain American sensibility into Britain.
Right.
You know, that
well, you brought over early blues artists, right? Was that in
part? Yeah, yeah, but the British knew about the blues, but it's right. more about a way of producing. I think you know, I was very fortunate. My mentors as producer, mm-hmm. the first one was Paul Rothschild, who I right. knew from Harvard Square.
Right.
He just was around the folk scene. And I ended up kind of tagging along with Paul to a lot of his sessions. And he would let me keep the, you know, write down the track listing on the back of the tape box. And I would help move microphones around and sometimes, you know, make suggestions and things like that. But it was such a great learning experience. And then, so then when I went to Britain, to London, I was ready. I felt I want to produce records. That's what I want to do. And my first, for a month or two, I slept on the sofa of a guy called Bill Leader, who was the main producer of traditional folk music for the Topic label. Mm. And he couldn't have been more different from Paul Rothschild. He used to take a Studer two-track and set it up in his kitchen and put a lot of egg crates, you know, on the walls and bring musicians in and hang one microphone in the middle of the room and make great records.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot from him about how you treat musicians, how yeah. you run a session to get that moment to yeah. happen where everything comes together. So it was, you know, I can't deny that the 60s was a kind of idyllic
and you did
time.
Work with, yeah. And you did work with some, I don't want to say fragile artists, but you know, you worked yeah. with Sid, you worked with Nick, and then on the other yeah. hand, you worked with yeah. John Martin. So, you know, you had yeah. You had the gamut there. All right. Well, I want to, before we leave, I want to do a little bit about what you're going to be doing in Saugerties. I live in Saugerties.
Okay.
So I know you're coming to town. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing. I wasn't aware of the Hendrix film, but go ahead and tell us what you're doing, where you're appearing.
Oh, Tuesday night, I'll be at the local. Mm-hmm. And I will read a little bit from the book. We'll play some music. We'll take questions. I'll tell stories from the book, mm-hmm. And illustrate them with sounds. And maybe I think we're going to throw some photos on the wall and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it's great what the local is doing. I mean, I gather that Saturday they've got a tube and throat singing group.
Yes. And they have a workshop too, I think. You know.
Yeah, and it's just terrific. Isabel and
Danny.
Danny, yeah. are doing such a great job there. And I worked with Danny before. He was the producer of the town hall tribute to Kate McGarrigle after she died.
Oh,
where we had Rufus and Martha and a lot of, you know, Emmylou Harris and all, you know, Teddy Thompson and all these people. It was a great night. It was a great evening. And it was filmed.
And you said something about the Hendrix film. When is that? Is that?
That's the night, Monday night of the cinema next
you
door.
You mean at Upstate Films?
Yeah.
What's it called? It's called Upstate Films. It's the Orphan Theater. They have two.
Yeah, exactly. The Orphan. That was, I wanted to make sure I was the right place. The Orphan. They've rented the Jimi Hendrix documentary that I made right after he died.
Right.
And so I'll introduce it and do a Q&A and stuff like that. And
I might swing by for that one. I think I'll be
cool.
Because I just did. They actually, speaking of guitar styles, I just did a story for Pop Matters on Ellen McElwain. I don't know if you were familiar with her.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
You know, they screened that last week, maybe 2 weeks ago, and she. Her slide style is very much what you're talking about, the notes between the notes, you know, very.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and that slide thing is another great example of things spreading around the world, because it was all developed in Hawaii by one guy.
Yeah.
You know, he was the first one, put an open tuning and slide a bar, and it went crazy. It went all over the world. Everybody went crazy for that sound.
Yeah.
And you hear it in Java and Congo and.
George Harrison.
And then, of course, George Harrison, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Two great books. Two great books. This is the one you got to go get now.
Yeah.
The Roots of the Rhythm Sea, right there.
Yeah, and it'll then, be for sale on Tuesday night.
Great. And then you should bring along some of these, because this is great.
Yeah, I think they've got some, yeah.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Okay, thank you. All the best.
Ciao.
Betty said she prayed today for the sky to blow away, or maybe stay. She wasn't sure. For when she thought of summer rain calling for her mind again, lost the pain and stayed for love. Gonna see the river man, gonna tell him all I can about the band. If he tells me all he knows about the way his river flows, I don't suppose.